The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Psychovertical podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Nice to be back. I feel like I only did this yesterday, but time seems to be kind of losing all its kind of meaning. Like, I feel like I haven't got enough hours in the day at the moment, but yet at the same time, like, time seems kind of endless. Like, I'm living in this house with my sort of mother-in-law and father-in-law and my brother-in-law. Is it dysfunctional? I don't know. We've not had too many arguments, but my father-in-law I hope he won't be listening to this, but he's kind of mad. He's kind of insane. He's trying to, I've probably mentioned this before, he's trying to basically cure cancer by something to do with, like, the genome. So he does it on pieces of paper. So he has all these thousands and thousands and thousands of sheets of paper with dots on, and he's manually going through the human genome, and he's comparing it to something else, and there's lots of highlighting, there's lots of sellotaping sheets of paper together, but recently he's been distracted by this thing that's going on at the moment. I don't like to mention its name, and so he's trying to cure that before everybody else does. So he's got all sorts of interesting ideas about what's going on he's one of these people where I'd like to make a film. So he calls it sequences. Like, he basically spends every day doing his sequences, and he's been doing this for maybe like 20 something years or something, and I'd love to make a film about him doing it, because you can't tell if he's probably totally insane. He won't mind me saying this about him. You can't tell he's either totally insane or he's an absolute genius. Now, he is actually someone who is, you know, he went to Oxford University. He was like an amazing sort of mathematician. He was, you know, involved in computers before computers were a thing. So he is actually a genius. But it's very hard to tell. There's a very fine line between someone who's a genius and someone who's like totally mad, because, you know, the way he's trying to do it, doing it by hand with pieces of paper, I kind of suspect that even if he did manage to find a cure for cancer or find some important sort of piece of evidence towards something, I just don't think anyone else could understand it apart from him. So, you know, like, if he died tomorrow, all that information would just disappear into the atmosphere. But he kind of lives in his robe, you know, like those robe things that people wear when they go swimming, when they're getting changed. Well, that's kind of all he wears. So he's kind of this kind of messianic. Anyways, he looks like Jesus, basically. Like a sort of 70-year-old Jesus, like, walking around in his robe. He doesn't get out of bed till about 2 o'clock. He's a bit like a Roald Dahl kind of character. Gets out of bed about 2 o'clock, and then he probably goes to bed about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he's kind of walking around the house and doing his stuff. So so that's kind of so yes, that's kind of funny. And so so that's Jeff. Jeff's my father-in-law, and then my brother-in-law is Jeffrey. So it's, there's some kind of a Scandinavian thing going on, you know. So he's like Jeff, and then they call his son the same name. Jeffrey is a barrister, but he's like the most super precise person I've ever met. Like when he's scraping his plate into the bin, it takes about 10 minutes because he's, you know, so precise. So you know, so it's kind of funny, like living in this house, and then mother-in-law is you know, it's like 75-year-old like woman who's like very, like tons of energy. Like she was like up the ladder, like cleaning all the windows yesterday. And I was like, is she not a bit old to be like cleaning the windows? Like we're sitting there like reading the newspaper, you know, in like, oh yeah, by the way, thank you. Someone sent me the, what you call that, glass building, conservatory. That's what it's called, on the side of a house. Like I couldn't remember what it's called. So, you know, we're sitting in the conservatory watching this 75-year-old woman, you know, on a ladder, like cleaning all the windows. I'm like, oh, do you think she's a bit old to be like cleaning the windows? You know, and maybe she'd get like a window cleaner. Instead of like jumping up and saying, oh, I'll clean the windows, you know, I can't be asked doing that. So I always, one of my all time heroes is Quentin Crisp. If anybody doesn't know who Quentin Crisp is, then go on YouTube and look at what Quentin Crisp is like. An amazing guy. I think I've probably mentioned him on here before. Like what one thing I loved about Quentin Crisp is he just didn't care what anybody thought about him. Like he just said exactly what he thought. Like he didn't really take any sides. So like, you know, like he was like one of the first probably openly gay people in, you know, in entertainment. Well, he wasn't in entertainment, he was like a writer really, but he was he did a great documentary, it was a book anyway. There's a real good thing, The Naked Civil Servant, because he had a job as a nude model in London, so he was technically like a civil servant and he was there naked. So it was a very good drama, is it drama, made about him, starring that man, John Hurt. It's very good. Anyway, I think there's a sequel as well. And that Sting song, is it an Alien in New York? Is it an Alien? Anyway, that Sting song is a bit terrible, isn't it? If you end up like, ask people to know who you are because of a song that Sting sung. So Sting song. So my point. Yes. Yeah, so Naked Silver Servant. John Hurt, Quentin Crisp. Quentin Crisp, everyone, you know, like he was openly gay and he didn't like Princess Diana. You know, like if you were gay, everyone had to love Princess Diana. And he just said she was horrible or something. So anyway, look him up, Quentin Crisp. Interesting character. But back to my point, Quentin Crisp believes that if you didn't dust, the dust only got to a certain depth and then it stopped growing. Which is probably true. So I've tried to sort of tell that to my mother-in-law, but she doesn't believe me that's true. But people don't seem to dust as much as they used to do. I don't know why. It's a bit like, you know, when you used to drive around in a car when you were younger, like the windscreen was always covered in dead insects. And people often say like, oh, there's no dead insects, not so many dead insects. That means it's like because of climate change, there aren't so many insects around. But it's primarily to do with like aerodynamic. The shape of cars is more aerodynamic, so maybe the shape of houses is more dust resistant. Maybe so it's not as dusty. I guess it did used to be bloody a lot of pollution when you were a kid. There's a lot of pollution, so people were smoking and everything else. So maybe that was, I mean, people shed more skin in those days. People, maybe there was like more skin shedding going on. I think that's what a lot of dust is skin, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, it's a bit of a disgusting sort of topic. But my point is, so here in Ireland, they call it cocooning. You're not allowed to leave the house, which I don't really agree with. But we have come into contact with other people every now and again. It seems to be the level of kind of insanity, as insanity stroke you know, sticking to the rules, is based on how much television you watch, how much news you watch. And I got into a little bit of mini argument with somebody about this, and I said you need to, like, you know, get your news from more sources than you're having. And they were like, no, but I watch Channel 4 news, I watch BBC news, I watch ITV news, and I watch Sky news. And I was like, that exactly what I'm talking about. So anyway, you all know what I think about the news. The news is like, anyway. But the other day, my mother-in-law managed to sneak out. She managed to escape from the prison that is our house. And I was wondering today if in prisons, if every week, if all the prisoners ever like clap for the prison guards or something. Anyway, so she escaped from the prison, and you know, 1 minute she's there, next minute she's gone. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get into trouble. Like, the guards are going to come around. In Ireland, the police call the guards, so just not literally guards, and not actually guards here. They're not really highly effective in Ireland, the guards. So they kind of went, see where she's disappeared, and I was like, oh no, we need to track her out, like release the hounds, where could she have gone, get the drone up, you know, get a helicopter onto this. And then she came back, and she'd been like in the house for like a month. She has been going on little walks around, but she's been in the house for like a month. And she'd been to the bank. Now, the bank's only like 200 metres away from the front door. But anyway, that's, you know, she could have like bumped into a lot of small children, or who knows what could have happened. So she went to the bank, and the security guard, there was a security guard outside the bank for some reason. And he asked her how old she was when she wanted to go in. He said, I'm 75. And he said, you can't come in, you're too old. So she was like, what? You know, she's like, she's a fiery Irish woman, you wouldn't want to do that. And you know, she's been like going to that bank for, you know, maybe like 50 years, maybe longer, like all her life has been going to that same bank, and now someone's saying she can't go in there to pay her bills. So anyways, the guy was obviously so intimidated, he went in, and he allowed her to go in. Like, there was no one in the bank, by the way, like, no, you know, you know, only three people out in the bank at a time anyway, but there's nobody around here. And so she came back, and she was all, you know, like, oh God, you know, like, you know, sort of kind of pissed off and disturbed at the same time. And so being tech savvy, I kind of tweeted to the bank, AIB in Ireland, and was like, you know, my mother-in-law has just been in here, and, you know, she wasn't allowed in, and, you know, she's no threat to anybody, and this is like some kind of social euthanasia. I thought that was quite good, social euthanasia of old people. Because I really don't think that the government or, you know, the state give a fuck about old people. I really don't. So it's, you know, whatever's going on is nothing to do with old people. So she, but usually when you tweet these things, you always get a response quite quickly, because there's like some, you know, someone's like sitting there, like, it's paid to see any tweets that come up that are negative, and they reply, and they, of course, like straight away they kind of replied like, oh, we're very sorry to hear about this, and can you tell us what branch it was, and da, da, da. And it's one of those things, as soon as you see that, you're like, well, I don't want to get anyone into trouble for this, like, and I was just like, just tell people that it's not, you know, this is not the law, that old people can't leave their houses, you know, this is like, you know, this is advice, it's not, you know, legally binding, you know, you can't go to prison for leaving your house. Just tell people that, because people don't know what the fuck they're doing. So, but, what I kind of failed to apply, which I try and do this as much as possible, but it's kind of hard, because I'm a human being, and human beings are generally just faulty in all manner of things, if you always try and think the best of everybody, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, and try and see it through that person's perspective. Now, this security guard is probably, like, I've seen him there, he's not Irish, he's he's black basically. His accent, he sounds like he's maybe from like Nigeria or somewhere. Like he's obviously not been here very long, and he is coming from a different culture to Ireland. Now he's probably coming from a culture where people have a lot of respect for older people. Now, people don't have any respect for older people in the West, basically. You know, we think we do, but we all think they're either paedophiles or they're baby boomers who, like, you know, got cheap houses and all that kind of stuff. We respect our own, you know, grandparents to some degree, but not that much. We don't really care that much. We don't see them. We don't interact with them, you know. We don't even interact with our parents, really. So we have a this completely fragmented, you know, sort of family structures and things. But this guy probably didn't. He probably came from, like, when you travel to a lot of these countries, like, you know, people who are older, you know, they have like a lot of respect. You know, people treat them with respect. They talk to them with respect. They listen to what they say. They have a lot of control and all this kind of stuff. And so a different way of looking at it is, this security guard, he sees this old woman coming, and his first thought is that, I don't want anything bad to happen to this woman. Like, I don't want this woman to go in there and get the virus from one of my other, you know, from one of these people who are already in the bank, or from the bank tellers or whatever. And I just prefer it for her benefit if she didn't go in the bank, because it made me feel like I'm doing my job here. I'm here to protect, you know, protect her and protect all the customers. But, you know, so I reckon that is exactly what he was doing. He wasn't like, I've got the power. You're an old woman. You're too old. You're not allowed into this bank. Just go away. But that's how you kind of, you know, your human response, like your monkey brain, is just that, how dare you not let me go into my bank? Like, this is my human rights to pay my bills. I should add, she should bloody be paying her bills online anyway, and she doesn't have a debit card or anything. Like, it's like, you know, she had to send some money recently, and she had to get like a bloody bank draft. Like, what is it? I don't even know what a bank draft is. So maybe it's like a lesson. A lesson can be learnt from all sides. My mother-in-law is kind of interesting, because she lived in South Africa for a while, and she's thinking, always try and think the best of people. Like, these are, you can scale this all the way up to politicians and everybody else in society. Is she once said to me, I'm working like a black, and I was like, now that's going to be offensive to some people, me saying that, but just hang on before you start switching off. So like, it's one of those things, like, old people can say things. I can remember my granddad, you know, he would say like pretty racist things, but, you know, until the age of 50, he'd probably never met anybody who wasn't, you know, like, didn't come from Hull where he came from. Anyway, and I was like, oh my God, you can't say that. And she was like, why not? I'm like, well, it's kind of racist saying that. It's like, and she was like, but when I lived in South Africa, like, black people worked really, really hard. And I thought it was a good thing. I thought it was like, you know, working really hard is you working like a black person. So I was like, I probably wouldn't say it again, but I understand where you're coming from, but it's just, you know, it's very interesting sometimes trying to dig down why people, what they're actually saying. There's so much, like, this is one of my pet things about how human beings are very bad at communicating with each other, and very easily misunderstand what each other's actually saying. And I think that's probably why that's probably the problem with social media. You know, if you can actually sit down with somebody, like in this podcast, you know, so many people will often say, like, when you actually say it, it sounds different. Like, I can actually, when I can hear, like, the way you're speaking, like, I've not got a voice that sounds like someone who is full of, you know, I'm not a sort of bitter person. I'm not like an angry person. I'm not a, you know, I don't hate anybody. I actually really want to get on with everybody. And so when you actually hear someone saying it, it makes a huge difference. And you tend to give people more, you see the human side, you give more of the benefit of the doubt to somebody. Because like, well, this person sounds, you know, it's not crazy. You know, like if I was to read out some of my emails I sent to people, you know, it's just not like a crazy person, you know, because you're just, it's like condensing. It's got all the, you know, it's just the bricks. You've got no mortar in there. It's just this like, that's like all this bits of information that you're trying to send at the same time. And you don't see like the nuanced kind of human side of these kind of things. So I'm endeavoring to try and think more like this. Like there's a lot of people are talking about how people have handled things badly and you know, all this kind of stuff, and there's going to be like, you know, repercussions and what's the other words? Anyway, there's going to be shit going on for a long time. People saying, why didn't we do this? Or you did this? Or blah blah blah. But like, I really don't think anyone really. In certain stages, people start thinking, how can I turn a profit from this situation, or how can I do this? But I think I don't think people like play too many games when they're under like a lot of pressure. Like if you're, you know, another thing at the moment is one of my little things about trying to improve your. So this is about improving the landscape, your mental landscape in your brain, in your mind, to try and be a healthier person, like to have better mental health. And one thing is to avoid speaking in headlines. And you know, if you want to speak about something, you should really try and understand it before you get like angry, or you know, start using it as a kind of weaponized headlines, like, you know, this person is an evil person, they've done this. It's like, in order to win an argument, really, you know, you don't really know what you're talking about. You're just going by like a headline you saw on Twitter or Facebook or something. Like, you know, the more you read into everything, what people say, what they do, it takes like the fire out of it, really, and it becomes so complicated. You know, the world is a multi-dimensional, and it's, you know, like for every kind of like thing you're completely sure about, there's some universal truth, but most of it is just multi-dimensional, and it doesn't become about the truth, or it just becomes about you being right in that moment and stuff. So I don't think in headlines, because I tried to avoid reading any headlines. So It's quite good listening to podcasts that are maybe 2 months ago. Like all the podcasts I'm listening to at the moment are all talking about the thing happening maybe at the moment. So it's quite good. It's quite good to see, you know, you're further down the line when people are giving advice of what to do or what's going to happen in the future. Like when you're in the future, it's a good, it's quite interesting to see. Like I'm a huge fan of, there's a series, Firing Line, on YouTube, and it's from the 1950s to, you know, it's from the 60s going up into the 80s. William Buckley, William Buckley was famous for, you know, falling out with Gore Vidal. There's a good, there's a really good documentary on Netflix, I think. It's Gore Vidal and William Buckley. And Gore Vidal, like, comes out as, like, the hero of it, and you know, Buckley's this kind of like narrow-minded, conservative asshole kind of guy. It's designed for a certain audience. But like with all these things, if you make the effort to go back and actually watch loads of episodes of Firing Line, which was maybe like the 30 minutes an episode, you know, but you've got like interviews with Buckley and you know, like Noam Chomsky and you know, like loads of people, like from the left and from the right, over decades, and it's like really, really great, really, really interesting. If you're interested in understanding the world we're in now, it's quite interesting to go backwards, you know, 20, 30 years and see what people were talking about, how they thought things would happen, and all these like minor characters who often were really interesting, but no one even knows who they are anymore. So it made me, you know, you could have this kind of Netflix documentary view of Buckley and Govardhal, and or you can actually go and spend like, you know, 50 hours of your time trying to understand, and watch some Govardhal documentaries. Like Govardhal's like very, very interesting character, but it takes effort. You know, why put the effort in when you can just read a headline? So I should really get on. I've been like rabbiting on. So I mean, consciously trying not to make that noise, that clicking noise. So hopefully I've not been doing it. I thought maybe I was gonna, because I've not really got any interesting stuff to talk about. I'm still in the middle of, well, I'm almost at the end of doing this Down book. So I've just emailed everybody out. Emailed to loads of people, the backers of the book, to sort of update their contact details to send it out. So I'm really hoping I can have it done like within the week. So I'll get that off, and then I'll be amazing. Like it's very, very bad to say something's tough. You know, a lot of people have really hard jobs, and this is kind of my job. But it's the mental strain of doing a book all by yourself. Like just writing a book is kind of it's a little bit tricky because it's always in your head. But when you're like illustrating in it and designing it and stuff, like even like at the moment, I'm just trying to. I've got one more chapter to like finish off the drawings, which I keep putting it off to the end. But I'm going back over loads of old loads of chapters I've already written, and it's just there's two full stops there, or there's not a space there between this the title and the thing, and it's all these like tiny little micro adjustments. I had like a picture of two knives, and I was like, oh really, and the knives are to scale properly. I have to like Google and find out what the actual length of the knives are, because that knife's a bit too big than the other one, and oh, I need to add in another knife because that knife's, you know, and it's lots of really tiny little things that just take so much time. And, you know, I think the older you get, the more you realize how time is so, you know, you just don't get it back. It's the one thing, like most of us, we make a living by selling our time. You know, we're not selling our, you know, we're not necessarily selling our skills or our muscle power. We're selling our time. Because time is this, you know, they're not. It's like it has no value, but yet it's the most, you know, they don't make it. They don't make in, you know, that second that just went past. Then, you know, it's you know, can't have it back again. So, so I thought maybe what I should, maybe what I'll do, I'll because there's nothing really going on. I'll do a bit of reading. I'll read something from some sort of booky type thing. I'm doing that thing now. I think I make that noise, and I'm not really sure what the hell I'm doing. So I probably do it quite a lot. So the last podcast, the last two like reading podcasts. So I read a copy of I read one thing, which was I read the Sea of Dreams, which was kind of non-linear, but only by only small bit, and then I read a block of wood, which was more kind of abstract. So I'm gonna read you this short. Again, it's only short. It's how long is it? This one's a little bit longer. It's like one, two, three. Maybe six pages long, and this is something where this was written for a magazine, so it's got more thought went into it. Where I think the other ones didn't; they were just like written for a blog, so they were kind of like banged out a lot quicker. I think this was written for Climb magazine in about 2014, and it's a another chapter from this book I wrote, this book that I did wrote, what's it called? Unknown Pleasures. And so I've not read this since I wrote it in 2014. So I'm reading it blind. So I shall read it, and we'll see what it's like if it kind of still makes any sense. So it's called Queen Maudland. My tired copy of Queen Maudland, Antarctica, by Ivar Erik Tollefsen, is tatty, old, and in Norwegian. But it doesn't matter, because it has been treasured since I forked out a good chunk of my shop wages for it in 1995. It has made it through countless house moves, had tea spilt on it, been stuffed under chairs, and dodged piss beside the toilet. The beauty of this book is that the pictures speak for themselves. They tell a tale of a big team in a remote place, climbing hard and pushing boundaries. This simple book is a book of dreams, a window to the wonderland of ice and rock spires, so beautiful, remote and extreme, that you could be fooled into believing it's all a fantasy, but it is not. Down in the far, far south, there is a place as remote as the moon. Its summits are seldom frequented, and equally beyond all but those lucky enough to be deemed astronauts of stone. I love this book, and have revisited it many times, like the snapshot of an unrequited love, always believing its contents to be beyond my touch. This book was my first insight into the mind of the Norwegians, a race who were bred for the cold. To challenge a Norwegian in Antarctica is to enter a breath-holding contest with a mermaid. I saw that in order to be successful in the cold, high places, one should attempt not to think like a Brit, but like a Norwegian. And so I began my study, climbing with them, hanging out, spending more and more time, absorbing just what it was that made them tick. I climbed the troll wall in winter with two of their modern greats, skiers and explorers, Alex Gammer and Tormod Grandheim. We spent 14 days on the wall at an average temperature of minus 20 degrees C. During the second week, I found out it was the first trad route of Alex had ever done. Coming home, I felt a little jaded by the climb and unsure quite why I would spend so long on such a wall just to reach the top. All the pain didn't seem worth it when weighed against the prize. I'd somehow forgotten the lesson that no climb is in isolation from those that come before and those that will follow, that all such adventures lead to the next. 6 months after the troll, an email popped into my inbox from Alex, inviting me to join him and a bunch of base jumpers and skiers in Queen Maudland. I blinked as I read the email, then read it again. 2 months away from home, this was a long time. I suddenly doubted if I could leave my kids for that long. So I reached up to my bookshelf and pulled down Tollefsen's book, opened it, and looked once more at that cold heaven. I knew that whether or not to go was not my choice. After flying from Cape Town to Novo Base, the roar of a week of storm hid the silence of Antarctica from us. Where we waited in rocking porter cabins for a window in which to make the final jump into space. I got to know Espen, Shasti, Ingeborg and Jonas, an eclectic mix with zero or minimal skills for Queen Maudland. We practiced putting up tents, lighting stoves and packing pulks, knowing that Antarctica is no place for the novice. A tent the base jumpers put up was ripped to pieces in 5 hours. A Russian standing over its shreds announced, "Out there, you will die." With no chance of a rescue from the outside world, I lay in my bunk, feeling the wall bulge, and considered both our chances of success and of me making it out alive. I could really feel tensions in the group, a bunch of highly motivated and seemingly self-focused individuals strung together by opportunity. The only option was to make it work. On the seventh day, the wind died and we flew in. the noisy buzz of the twin otter wailing as we spiral down into an emptiness surrounding an emptiness between sprouting rock spires that would break the heart of any climber. With a skip, we landed and split out, shouting, laughing, and shedding the odd tear. This was followed by the smack of skis thrown down, the thump of bags, until all the fuselage doors slammed and the plane skipped away, lifted and turned to a pixel speck in blue. The drone of the engines faded to nothing in the frigid air. Then in my mind, the lingering memory faded, died, and the silence moved in for the kill. And then, like freezing cold water, there comes a shock of real silence. As ears strained, you try to hold on to something, real or imagined, from Earth. But with a rush, the silence slips through your ears and wipes away even that memory of old noises held there. That's when you know you are in Antarctica and you are alone and isolated as any human on Earth can be. On the first day, we clipped on skis and made our way up to check Ulvatana, a fortress of rock that broods on the edge of the cliffs that spill down onto the ice cap. I'd never seen such a mountain, and doubt nature had made any other like this. We stood and gazed up, mouths open, and marvelled at stark and lofty, as is a fortress against the dreams of the foolish men with high ambitions. This, though, was what we had come to climb, and then some of the team would make a base jump descent. It was a crazy idea, dreamt up in the bars of Oslo, but now playing reckless in the frozen light of Queen Maud Land. No, not reckless, because we would never get that far. It could only offer abject failure. The idea of climbing Ulvatana with such a team as this was pure fantasy. Four non-climbers, one climber who could crank 8A but didn't like loose rock or do aid, and me. The easiest route was the Huber route, which was A4 with obligatory hard free climbing. Was not really easy, just easier. It was like swimming the Atlantic instead of the Pacific because there would be fewer sharks. The idea of climbing such a line seemed impossible, and to get anyone up it harder still. But then to base and get down alive, that was fantasy. But I'm a dreamer and I like the impossible. The trick I find works best when approaching such a impossible objective is to think of something even more difficult. For example, I once had a plan to ski to the South Pole, which seeing as it was 1,000 kilometers of flat skiing, and it would make it quite a challenge. It seemed impossible, but when I tried to imagine crossing Antarctica, which would be twice as far and twice as impossible, all of a sudden, just skiing to the South Pole seemed reasonable. And so this was the approach I took for Ulvatana. I looked up at the mountain, a huge brooding castle of crumbling stone, and let my mind wander up the unclimbed South Ridge, the last great unclimbed line in Antarctica. A huge barrel-shaped wall barred the way to a committing and obviously scary alpine ridge. It appeared to be the ultimate climbing challenge, bald, hard, long and dangerous. I imagined being up there in a storm, how there would be no way down, either from the ridge, which would involve going up and down towards towers and cols in either direction, or the barrelled wall. The route had been tried 3 times by strong teams and all had failed due to storms and no doubt a sense of that with each meter they were tightening the noose, a feeling that I'd had many times in Patagonia. I stood in my skis on the first day and laughed at the idea that this non-climbing team of tackling such a route, the sheer thought of it, crazy. It almost seemed that we could pull it off. The gods could never suspect such a surprise attack. I allowed myself to imagine such a thing, a trick to make me believe we could climb something else. But bit by bit, day by day, We made other climbs and ticked off a list of objectives. I allowed myself to look over and began to believe that in this dreamland, there could only be one objective. After all, we would never be coming back. Up and up we went, day, weeks, pitch after pitch, no one easy or safe, but never boring. I led most, but the others led too, each having some time in the at the sharp end, so we could never feel they were tourists or passengers. Shasti once said she didn't understand why I had to climb things that were hard and tough or gnarly. Why not just go skiing or base jumping? What was wrong with having fun? As we sat in the cooking tent, I told her that the greatest experience of our lives are the hardest, but that wondered if she was right. Was this beautiful woman so full of life and sunshine because she only sought out happiness and pleasure and thrill? Was I so full of conflict and darkness and turmoil because all I thought about was pain? But on Ulvatana, I think she got it. I trained her up to haul and Juma on B-Lane clean, and she became my main partner, standing for hours in the inhuman cold, willing me on, never complaining. In one hour you climbed 1 meter, she laughed once, when I rapped down from a chimney that was akin to being slowly wound through a mangle. Her words were full of smiles, not the resentment of standing there all day, where even in down trousers and jacket were no match for the danger of the Antarctic night. We climbed capsule style, first up the barrel wall and from a rock garden at the top, committed to each section, unable to get down unless we stripped the upper pitches. Each day, by twos and threes, we jugged up the slow disintegrating ropes and pushed them out, then descended the nerve-jangling ridge. Here and there were places I prayed no one would die, loose sections with hanging blocks and sharp edges that soared at 10 millimetres of nylon, no matter how cautiously you weighted the ropes. Each time we reached the tents, I felt a deep sense of relief before we'd scurry into sleeping bags and warmth, knowing it was only a matter of time before there was an accident. I slept beside Shasti in the same tent as Espen and Ingeberg, who had become as close as brother and sister, the lives of us all in my hands. I'd only seen my girlfriend back in Sheffield for about 5 weeks in the last year, both of us tied up in separate lives, separate dreams, a long isolation of loneliness. But now with this team, I felt the echo of that loneliness reflected in their relationship. One morning, I walked with my frozen arm around Shasti. As I lifted it, I heard the lightest of moans, a sound that caused my heart to break. For a moment, I thought I'd fallen a little in love, only a dreamland love, not a love that would last. Deep down, I knew it wasn't that. But as the feeling rose, that love I had at home could not withstand loneliness. It was simply not enough to keep me safe in places like this. The pitches rolled on and on, up and up, passing mousetrap walls and gardens of alien stone, until we thought we had reached the top, a horn that blocked the summit, a steep and twisted and gearless overhanging ridge, like the index finger raised to all those who had believed they could get this far. We were the first. It was beyond me how to climb it, but so had been so many other things on the South Ridge. So I tried, half aiding until a crack ran into crumbling mortar, leaving heavy boils of stone to bridge and slightly pull. And then I saw it, hidden from below, suddenly appearing, a hole just big enough for a man who had lost 15% of his body weight to pass into. But where did it go? To the top or somewhere else? I no longer cared. It was pothole tight, and I wormed away in tatty shell and ripped trousers, my boots now full of holes, tapping the stone until with a squeeze I popped out on a vertical face of Patagonian-style snow. Moments later, I fell, my fingers just grasping a Camelot 5. I willed myself on, all against failure, through the snow, and there was the summit of Ulvatana, only 30 metres of scrambling away, the last great climb, my arse. We reached the summit together and descended the same day. It was the longest, hardest day I'd ever spent in the mountains. 36 hours that pushed me so far I went deaf in one ear. It took us several days to recover, but bit by bit, we put ourselves back together and began to pack. The last day we spent removing all traces and leaving the wind to do the rest. Our snow walls were now rounded, not square. Our igloo deflated by the sun. What remained would be dismantled by the winter storms that were already gathering in the white. When the plane arrived, we jumped and whooped like Americans and then nervously packed it so tight we feared we'd never get off the ground. Then, one by one, we climbed in to leave, some clambering up like shipwrecked sailors dropped in a net, others lingering, one foot on the ice and the other on the rung of reality. I was the last aboard, climbing up slowly like a man walking away from his love, his heart broken, not daring to look back. The co-pilot looked before he closed the door, smiling. Somehow, we'd survived perhaps the most radical expedition ever to visit Antarctica. We had done it. We had fulfilled the chance we'd been given. The plane's engines fired and everyone whooped once more, all eager for food, showers and beds, all but one. "I don't want to leave," I said, staring out of the window, knowing that as soon as I would be back in the real world, I would no longer be the alpha male, but a human being who knew his life would fall apart after this. I knew Queen Maudland was not real. What we had done, felt and known with certainty, was unreal. These things, these mountains and experiences, a place in our imaginations, even if we never knew or acknowledged that they were there. "I think you should leave me," I said, my heart breaking. But my words were lost in the engine noise as the empty silence throttled back, retreated one more time, and with a roar, we flew back towards the world. So, that's... there's a few bits in there. There's some good bits in there. There's some bits that aren't so good. I don't think it needs like a connecting paragraph to identify that we actually decided to climb the wall. Like, basically, you could make this one story about Queen Maudland into like a 100,000-word book, and here it's maybe like 1,500 words. So you're trying to condense a lot of information into a very small, quite a small story, which is dead easy. You could write it as one paragraph, which would be, you could write in like 500 words, and that might be better than 100,000 words, and it might be better than this as well. Like, I'm not very good at reading it, so that kind of spoils it a little bit. But there's a few bits when I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, that sounds a bit cliched, or that sounds a bit too obvious. I think in a way you always want to be turning it down, turning your writing down, keep making it as simple as you can. Like, I can't see what, there was a few bits in here where it's like, oh god, I don't like that bit. So I guess this was written six years ago, and I think I don't feel I've really written anything of any, I don't feel I've written that much in those 6 years, but I do feel like I have a better idea of what I like in writing, and my bullshit cliche sort of meter detector is more finely tuned, really. So when I finish the down book, I am going into like writing a fictional book, and so hopefully, like, now if I can see this now in things I've written in the past, hopefully that gives me some confidence. I can see that as I'm writing something else, and just because it's very hard to write stuff that's simple. It's much easier to write something that's very flowery and full of all like lots of cliches, or where you just, everything is like bang, bang, bang. You're just describing every single thing that's going on. It's very subtle how you can like there's no description of Ulvatana here, and if you've not seen it, you know, it's quite interesting to imagine how you view it in your mind as I'm reading this. There's no description of any people. You don't know what they look like, but yet you've somehow got an image of them in your head, maybe. But the real depth in it is probably the idea that this thing about where I wake up with my arm around somebody else, that's kind of unusual. And it's, I don't know if I read it properly because I was shocked when I started reading it that I'd written that. So a very good, like, I think basically this, after this trip to Queen Maudland, I had a mental breakdown, and I think it was actually the culmination. It wasn't going to Queen Maudland. That was just that was the beginning of it, or maybe that was the end of it. That was like the, you know, like I think a mental breakdown is a really, really helpful, is a really good thing in a way. You know, you can, it's probably like a reset of, it's very damaging to everybody around you and stuff, but if you can somehow get through it, it's a very, I think after this trip, I think I realized there was like so much in my life that was in a mess, and stuff that had probably been unresolved for a long time, probably, you know, like relationship things, or how I saw the world. I always had a real chip on my shoulder. I kind of view the world. I think most people have a view of the world now. So it sounds a bit patronizing, but I think it makes people like mentally ill. I think this kind of view, this combative, you know, chip on my shoulder kind of view wasn't helpful to me as a human being to be happy or productive or whatever. So this was probably the breaking point where I came back and I just cut my whole life, like fell to pieces, basically, like kind of everything was, you know, there's some pieces that yet to be, you know, mended after this, like six years down the line. But it's kind of interesting. Like someone once told me that if you go on an expedition, you should never make any radical changes afterwards for about 2 weeks. That was her thing, because people often, like, you'll probably find this now with this, what's going on right now, is that, you know, people have this, you know, things have to change. I need to do, you know, I'm going to leave my husband, or I'm going to, you know, going to buy a dog, you know. You're going to do, you know, going to get a, you know, subscription to, you know, some, you know, Vogue or something, you know. But people, like, you know, they want to change something, and they make this big change. But I think often you do need to, maybe that's your monkey brain. Your monkey brain is maybe like in some kind of pain or whatever, and he wants an immediate, you know, I'm going to buy a friend of mine, he just bought one of those electric cars. God, my brain, what's wrong with my brain at the moment? I can't be asked thinking about it. Anyway, but one of those electric cars, you know what I'm talking about. Funny, because Vanessa, my wife, was like, oh, is it a hybrid one? It's like, no, they don't make a Tesla. Like, no, they don't make hybrid cars, Teslas, you know. Anyway, so, you know, it's obviously some kind of mental, it's obviously some kind of mental, you know, some sort of midlife crisis, like buying a Tesla or something. And especially when suddenly petrol costs like nothing, it's like free, basically. But people often do these things because there's something fundamentally wrong in their life, or something that needs to be changed or dealt with, but they can't deal with that, so they try and change some other things. You know, it's like, you know, say you've got some, you know, there's like a horrible smell in your house, and you don't know what it is, So instead of moving house, because you realise you've been built a house and over like an Indian burial ground, you know, you just start, you know, let's buy a bigger television or something, or let's start drinking more to hide the smell. So it's often interesting, these stories people write, when you actually know people, what was really going on. Often they're not very sort of truthful, and also people don't want to hear the whole story. Like you have that a lot when people are going through, you know, relationship problems. You know, I often say you can have one conversation about your relationship problem, and that's it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Like, and I'm not gonna have loads of emails with you about it, because it's pointless. You know, you just got to deal with these things. You know, eventually. We were watching one of those programs last night. There was like my 600 pound life, where someone weighed like 600 pounds. You know, this like ginormous, like woman. You know, and I was just like, I would just kill myself. If I was her husband, I would just kill her. You know, I'd put a pillow over her head and kill her just to put her out of her misery. And people were like, "Oh my God, how can you say something like that? That's terrible." It's like, no, but look at her. Like she's like it's beyond. You know, it's anyway. So I probably take that attitude into sort of other people, and they have like, for some reason, if you get in touch with them, some kind of relationship thing, it's like, you know, it's just like fiddling with a tooth, with, you know, like a bad tooth in your mouth. After a while, it's like you're actually getting something. You're getting something out of it. There's something. It's unhealthy. You know, just pull it. Just pull the tooth out, or stop going on about it. So I guess I'll probably wind that up at that point, because I don't know where I'm really going with this. But I know what's going with it. Maybe one of the tricks of writing or talking about these things is being able to talk about something that people are interested in but don't want to talk about or don't want to listen to. So my story about, you know, like my 75-year-old mother-in-law, you know, interacting with a Nigerian, you know, there's a story there. There's a lot of stuff about like, you know, immigration and race and culture and all this kind of stuff that we should always be talking about, because it's really, really interesting stuff and it's very revealing about us. But no one fucking talks about it because everyone's too afraid. So the ability to transfer some information about something, about you having a mental breakdown or something being wrong in your life, in a way that's very easy to read and it leaves it very open ended, is maybe that's the art of it, is trying to do that, where people will read what you've written or listen to you doing a podcast. So I had this thing in ages ago about having a locked in life syndrome, like locked in syndrome, but in your life. And I've had like amazing a number of people who email me like this exactly describes my life, and no one's ever said it like that before. This exactly describes my life. You know, this is just, so just using this one little term, locked in life syndrome, it's like that this person gets it. You don't need to go into it, you can just, you know, and I'm almost like, don't send any more emails, I'm not interested in your locked in life. So maybe that's the art of like writing, is trying to impart like a huge amount of data in as few words as possible. And I think I said last week to somebody, Cameron McNeish, I think, that writing is being able to put your words into somebody else's brain, or your ideas in somebody else's brain. So the bigger the idea, for the smallest number of words, is probably the ideal way of doing it. You know, a bit like how you used to get you'd buy a memory card for a camera, and you'd be like 1 megabyte, and it would cost you like 50 quid, and now you can get one that's like a terabyte, and it costs you, you know, the same amount of money. So there is that thing, you're trying to impart lots of information and in a very small space of time. So I apologize, that still wasn't a bit of writing where I'd be like, oh, that was really, really good. It still not that good in my mind, but it's kind of okay for what it is. I'll have to try and if I can finish this book next week, maybe I'll have to write something that works that could stand by and think that's, you know, as perfect as I can do. So yeah, so one last bit of housekeeping. I'm gonna do a talk this week, like a YouTube Facebook Live talk, and I think I'm gonna do it on Wednesday at 11 p.m. And it'll be on. I'm gonna do my slideshow I did like 2018, which is called, I think it was actually called Psycho Vertical, which is about. Some people probably have seen it, but it was about talking about my first trip to the Alps, and it's intermingled with stories about going to Solo, the Sea of Dreams, and things, and various kind of adventures went on. So that's going to be. I'll say it now. Is it 10 o'clock? No, 10. We'll call it because you have to try and do it at a time where people can watch it in America. And people can watch it in the UK and Ireland and places. No, we'll call it 7 o'clock. So if it's 7 o'clock, it's 8 hours behind. 7 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Yeah, is that right? 7 o'clock. Yeah. So we'll say 7 o'clock Wednesday night. I'm going to do Psycho Vertical, and it'll be on YouTube, and it'll be on probably on Facebook, and it's like Facebook Live. So if you go there and it says this slideshow is this little Facebook Live is at, you know, 3 a.m. Pacific time. It's actually, just ignore that bit. So anyway, so if you enjoy this podcast, you're welcome. If you didn't enjoy this podcast, you probably didn't get to this bit. And don't forget to subscribe and all that kind of stuff. Keep clicking on the YouTube thing. I need to get it up to, I need to increase it because it's, you know, for some reason I need to. That'll be it. So I shall go off and reduce all the noises in this podcast and upload it. Thank you very much.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.